Welcome to Solder Smoke, where we talk about all things electronic and geeky. We meet on Echolink and swap ideas related to workbench radio projects. If you have any questions about this podcast or suggestions for future casts, send a note to soldersmoke@yahoo.com. Our webpage is www.geocities.com/soldersmoke. As always, have fun, melt solder, and pass along your ideas.
KL7R on the Mendenhall Glacier near Juneau, Alaska. This is M0HBR in central London. Are you there, Mike?
Yeah, Bill. Long time no hear. M0HBR, KL7R. I've been keeping my ear out for you for a couple of weeks now. Hopefully you weren't too busy there the past couple of weeks. So.
Yeah, well, I was. Well, here we are. It's been a while. It's the 11th of February. It is 0619 hours GMT in London. Let's see, what time is it up there? I'm showing it. It's 9 o'clock at night up there. And anyway, here we are back on Solder Smoke. Yeah, I've been busy at work and lots of other projects going on and haven't had time to generate a whole lot of Solder Smoke or another episode, but the emails have been coming in from our loyal listeners, so I think it's good for us to put out another edition and to the Solder Smoke community. No real ham radio technical progress here. I tucked the experimental methods under my arm a couple times as I went off to work and spent lunch hours reviewing that book and continuing the study of amplifier design. But I haven't been playing with LT Spice or copper clad boards or anything like that. I hope to do a little bit of that this weekend. The only technical progress to report here is the arrival in London of the Dobsonian Newtonian telescope. And I've headed out in the backyard and from my microscopic London yard, I've been able to see surface features on the on Mars. See a little bit of the, I guess what Percival Lowell called the canals, and could see them a little bit there. Little shades of darkness. Mars is not as close as it used to be. A few months ago, it was a lot closer, but anyway, able to see something there. So, what have you been up to? And have you been generating solder smoke there in Alaska, KL7R and 0HBR?
Sure, good to hear you again, Bill. I had a real busy week, long around the first of the year there. So took me a couple of weeks to recover from it. I must have worked harder than I thought. Yeah, fine on your Dobsonian Newtonian telescope there. I heard they call the backyards in England, they call them gardens. So I wonder if it's about the size of my wife's potato garden there. Fine on seeing the canals on Mars. The best I ever saw, I had a little cheap telescope that I had set up in the backyard, and I saw the space between the rings of Saturn, and I was really happy with that, and I could see mountains on the moon. I never saw any details on Mars. So I did see him kick the SuitSat out of the ISS there. That was something else. It looked a lot like science fiction. It was at work. I knew it was going to happen about the time it was going to happen, and so I hitched up to NASA TV. Over the internet. that was a lot of fun. It's a lot like some of the terrible science fiction movies you see of a suit rolling out. Thing only made it two orbits, so I never got a chance to hear it. But I did hear what some other guys recorded on it. So that was pretty cool. I did melt some solder, mostly hacking current hardware I have, current, just kind of fiddling with current gear I have there, Bill.
Yeah, KL7R, M0HBR. Yeah, the SuitSat thing was interesting. I didn't hear it, but as somebody who's played with amateur satellites, obviously an interesting project. I was tempted to fire up my my VHF converters and see if I could pick it up. But yeah, I had a lot of fun listening to low Earth orbit satellites, RS-12, RS-13, Mir Station. I think I told you I spoke to Mir Station fairly regularly from the Dominican Republic, and that was quite a series of CUSOs. Yeah, and my SUTSAT seemed to get a lot of attention. It was showing up on Yahoo News and everything else. And I wonder why it didn't last. I don't think it lasted as long as they expected it to. I guess if you just throw something out there and it's flipping around like that, it might be hard to keep it cool, because it'll heat up on one side, or it's a complicated thing. Yeah, I like looking at the planets. I mean, from central London, you're not going to see any real deep sky objects. You're not going to see too many galaxies out there. And if you do see them, you're not going to see much with a small telescope like mine. But I got back into amateur astronomy in 94. I was in the Dominican Republic, and that was the time that the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 was going to hit Jupiter. And I'll never forget it. The morning that it was going to hit, I had been going out looking at Jupiter a few nights before the impact, and I had a night watchman at my house in the Dominican Republic, and this guy got interested in astronomy. It was amazing. Just because I would take the telescope out, and whenever he was there, I would say, "Hey, Antonio, you want to take a look at this?" And he'd look. He really got interested in it, and so he would spend the rest of the evening kind of teaching himself the sky as he sat out in front of my house. And I would, without telling him what was going on, I said, "Look at Jupiter, look at Jupiter," and I told him to kind of study the surface features, because you could see the bands of clouds even with a 4.5-inch telescope. And he had better eyes than I do. And so when the impact took place, the next morning I went out and I looked at it, and I swore I could see a little black spot up in the upper right quadrant of Jupiter. But you know, sometimes, you know, if you want to see something, you could see it. You know, wishful seeing, they think they call it. But to prove it, I called Antonio over and I said, "Hey, take a look at Jupiter and let me know if you see anything different." And he says, "Oh yeah." He says to me in Spanish, he says, "There's a little black spot up there on the right." And those were early internet days. This was 94. And I got onto one of the CompuServe internet forums, and I just sent out this message. I said, "Hey, I'm standing here in hot and muggy Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, with a 4.5-inch reflective telescope, and I think I can see the impact crater on Jupiter." And a guy at the University of Chicago said, "Yes, you can. That's exactly what it looks like." So, great moments in astronomy and in amateur astronomy for me. Saturn is always the coolest. I don't know if I've ever seen the separation between the rings with my little telescope, but when we were in the Azores, we had a big backyard there, and I used to keep the telescope set up in the backyard. And if we had dinner guests over after dinner, after dessert, I would make everybody go out into the backyard, and we would look at Saturn and the rings, and that was always the one that really, really got them. I think that's the real jaw dropper astronomical object. Really, really beautiful. With Jupiter, you know, you get a little program, and they'll show you where the four Galilean moons are, and you can actually watch them go around and disappear behind the back of Jupiter and come out again around the front, and you can see their shadow on the tops of the clouds. It's pretty neat. Well, we're talking about electromagnetic spectrum at the very, very high end, I guess. KL7R, M0HBR.
Yeah, Bill, that's great, and I bet that was an awesome light your back on fire experience there, seeing that thing. I remember seeing that chain of pearls and then the multiple impacts. It's pretty stunning, humbling stuff there. And fine on the moons of Jupiter. Yeah, I don't know what it was. It was about maybe 3 years ago, something like that. I could take my my what are they, 10x50 binoculars, and I could see the moons of Jupiter. I could see a couple of them just with a pair of binoculars in the morning. I go to work and get out of my truck, and I took the binoculars with me, and I looked up at Jupiter, and you could see the moons, and there was this native guy there, and he said, "Man, check this out." And I pointed up at Jupiter, and he said, "Yeah, see the moons going around there?" And he dug that. Let's see. What have I done? Melting solder here. I've got a few notes of myself here. I spent a lot of that time working on the pickle counter with AA0ZZ, and he actually got it working up to about 20 meters. Doesn't work much higher than that. I built a little time domain reflectometer. It basically is a logic gate that you parallel five 200 ohm output logic gates together to get 50 ohm output, and this thing has an oscillator, and it just thumps the coax, and you look at the thump, and you look at the echo with your oscilloscope, and you can roughly calculate how long the coax is or where the break in the coax is. The reason I did that is a guy at work needed one. He said, "Hey, do you have a time domain reflectometer or a thumper?" I said, "No, but I'll look for a schematic." And I found a schematic, but I didn't have any parts, so I ordered the parts and built it. Now that he doesn't need it, but I'll have it handy if he ever needs it. What else? Did a couple hacking on current stuff I had. This here mic has got an RF speech clipper in it, a DF4, a Delta Lima 4 Foxtrot Zulu, I think, DF4ZF, Zulu Foxtrot, Zulu Sierra, DF4ZF, RF clipper. It takes your voice, audio bandwidth, and audio frequency, and then heterodynes it up to 455 kilohertz, and then overdrives it and clips it off hard, and then filters the noise created by the clipping, and then drops it back down to audio again. And I've got that inside of the mic for my FT817. You can't really tell on FM, but that's it turned on. But it really makes a big difference on sideband. Anyway, I got it wired up to my my main HF station. So I've been driving my HF station as hard as I can, and trying to make a fairly clean signal, but really you get like 2S units worth of difference. So that's like putting on an amplifier. M0HBR KL7R.
KL7R M0HBR. Yeah, I've been knowing that I should do more in the speech processing and audio side of my projects. It's all been very hit and miss. I pay much more attention to the RF portion of the circuitry, and I think that I suffer because of the neglect of the audio portion. For example, on my 40 meter double sideband rig, it's putting out with a little outboard amplifier, with the Ramsey kit outboard amplifier, I can get about 20 watts out of the thing. And my antenna is not that bad. It's like a 40 meter kind of drooping dipole, and I should be making more contacts. The contacts should be easier than they are. And I think one of the reasons I'm not doing it is because I think the audio, I think I'm putting too much of the power is going out and not the right portion of the audio spectrum, if you know what I mean. It's not optimally processed. So because I haven't paid any attention to it, but I really need to do more of that. And it's always interesting to listen to some of the real audiophiles on especially on 20 meters. They really get into it. And my when I think about my little my audio chain consists of one 741 op amp. With that, kind of pathetic, but should probably do more in that area. There's a good article in QST a while back in the QRP column about building an equalizer, kind of an outboard equalizer arrangement. And the guy had rigged up kind of a boom mic, and and all that kind of stuff. And that was very kind of inspiring. I'd like to do more of that in that area. I did make one contact on 40 meter DSB with my little homebrew rig, I guess a week or so ago. And then I was in the middle of it, interrupted by a telephone call from work. So that was kind of frustrating. But hopefully we'll have clearer sailing this weekend. There won't be too much. I don't know. I've got to think of something to build or something to work on, or maybe I'll just get on the air. I fired up the HW8 a couple times. I have it rigged up with the Volkswagen solar power array, the solar panels that came out of Volkswagens that I bought on eBay, and that worked out okay. I think I made a couple of QSOs there. It's kind of fun to do it with solar power. We've talked about that. This is not the best place in the world to do solar power, but anyway, it's kind of fun to know that your electricity is homebrewed also. And I'm getting ambitious about a new antenna. What I have up on, I'm in kind of a townhouse here, Mike, and it's sandwiched between tall buildings. I have a pretty good, I can see the horizon to the southwest. The north, not too good. The east, not as good as the west. The south's not that bad. I have right up now, I have a couple of mostly horizontal doublets. And I have a dipole kind of support made out of two fishing poles. A picture of it on my website, because the same antenna used to be above my house in the Azores. Now it's above my house in London. But I think I'd be better off here with just a vertical. I had a vertical up before, and I got out better with that than I do with the current arrangement. So maybe in the springtime, I'm going to order one of these 30-foot telescoping fishing poles. They're advertised, GQRP Club, I think, has them. And I'm going to get one of those and just put 30 feet up, and then just, you know, have a bit of wire strapped to it, and throw out some, maybe use the current antenna as a counterpoise, and in essence get a sort of a quasi ground plane up there. Yeah, there's some good ham radio antenna talk. Hey, one more thing about the moons of Jupiter. Got a couple astronomical topics on Jupiter. There's this little program called GalSat. You get it. It's a free download, and what it does is it's a real small program, but it gives you a readout of where the moons of Jupiter are at any given time. And you get two readouts. One is kind of the looking down on the orbital plane of the satellite. So you see Jupiter in the center, and you see these four little lines going around it, and it shows, you know, where they are, and it shows the direction to the sun and the direction to the Earth. And at the bottom of the screen, you get kind of Earth view, what it would look like if you were looking at it through a telescope. And you could progress it by time. So you hit the one of the buttons on the keyboard, and it progresses, you know, 5 minutes up, 5 minutes up, 5 minutes up. And so you can march the moons around Jupiter. But the weird thing is that as you're marching them around, the Earth view is changing. But I discovered that as I moved one of the moons behind Jupiter, it didn't disappear on the Earth view. And I would have to wait a while before it disappeared on the Earth view. And I thought, man, there must be something wrong with the program, because up here on the top, I've moved Callisto behind Jupiter, but down here at the bottom of the screen, it shows Callisto still visible in the telescope view. And then it dawned on me, speed of light. Jupiter's way out there. KL7R, M0HBR.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah, I remember the guys going to the moon. I remember I was in high school, and my dad went to this bar. He rarely went to a bar, but he went there for lunch and had a Gibson. And and they were showing the moon landing, and it was really interesting hearing the 2 second delay there. That taught me about the speed of light. Cool on all that stuff there. I could talk antennas all day long. I love antennas, but I want to mention you were talking about equalizers, and there's some software, some sound card software. If you go to www.romacsoftware.com, there's a bit of software for $40. It's a 10-band equalizer, and it does noise gating and all that stuff that the expensive hardware equalizers do. So you might experiment with that. You might also experiment with just driving the heck out of your audio into a pair of back-to-back diodes and just clip the top and bottom off your audio, and then run that through a low-pass filter to clip off the highs, high frequency garbage that gets created when you do that. That's a real cheap clipper. And then there's also compressors you can get. There's some pretty good compressor chips you can get. Don't cause the distortion you hear in clippers, and they do a pretty good job of compressing the audio. So you might try that. Build a compressor, or maybe you can build a compressor out of some sort of a 741 integrating amp or something like that, or something like that. It might be an interesting project to find a compressor circuit you could add to your DSB rig. Be just another op amp. What else? Your antennas. That sounds like I never have been a fan of verticals, but I found out recently that my inverted V has been working really well in state. I have a horizontal 80 meter loop that I just loved, and it works great on 20 meters and all that. But I put up this low inverted V. It's a 100 foot wire. Actually, it's more complicated than that, but it's basically a G5RV, only not 100 foot dipole-ish thing in an inverted V configuration, and it works really well on 80 for some reason. It's surprising me. It doesn't act like any of the other verticals I put up, so maybe it's not a vertical. My next door neighbor, I found out, I got that Arrow satellite antenna, and the first thing I did with the Arrow satellite antenna was use it on AM on 2 meters to DF the noise sources around my house. And found out the noise sources around my house are coming from my neighbor, and they started around Christmas time, so I think he's still got some Christmas lights with a staple through the wire, because it started around Christmas time. But as far as your antennas, that sounds like a plan. Yeah, I got a 20-foot fishing pole, not a 33-foot one, and I've got two 14s that collapse down and are fun to play with. But what I've done with them is stick a slinky on them and run them up. That way the slinky is a linear loaded vertical, and you could probably get a quarter wave 80 meter vertical on a 33-foot mast doing that. I don't know if you've ever played with slinkies, but they're a lot of fun. I built a two element Yagi one time for 15 meters. Slinkies. Anyway, back to you there, Bill. M0HBR and the long-winded KL7R. Over.
KL7R, M0HBR. Yeah, well, interesting stuff. Well, thanks for the tips on the equalizers. I'm going to have to look into that. I particularly like the diodes with the filtering afterwards. Kind of a way to do it. I'll have to look at that. And I do need to get into the audio area. Although this could be dangerous, I think, because you could become obsessed. I think the guys who are really into this will admit that is a danger. And it's interesting to listen to the conversations. Oh, man, the guy from New Jersey, I listen to him all the time, Bill from New Jersey. I talked to him quite a few times. Nice fella, and he's sort of the guru. W2ONV, I think that's it. Bill in New Jersey on 14285, I think. And I always enjoy listening to him. But those guys are really, really into it. And I'll have to look at that. Oh, yeah, I meant to mention your Time Domain reflectometer. That's a, you're a true home brewer there, Mike. And it's, you know, you never know when you need a time demand reflectometer. So it's good that you have one handy and that you can whip one up if someone needs one. And let me put there we go. There's a better view and kind of collapsed Echo Link. Lots of good. It sounds like you've been doing quite a bit of progress there. Well, you mentioned watching the moon landing, and I guess I somehow, probably because I haven't been doing enough soldering here, that I keep going back to astronomy, but this is ham radio related. You mentioned your father watching the moon landing. It reminds me of probably the only movie ever made about an antenna. I don't think we've discussed it on Solder Smoke, but this could be, hey, wait a second, time for a new feature. Solder Smoke movie review. The Dish. Have you seen this thing? What an amazing movie. Out of Australia. It's about the Parkes telescope, the radio telescope in Australia. And they were given the mission to receive the signals from Neil Armstrong's landing and first steps on the moon. I think actually it was the first steps that they were gonna pick up the signal for. You know, the Earth Moon configuration at the time was Australia was facing the moon, so they were the only ones to be able to get it. And NASA sent a guy down to kind of work with the telescope personnel to make sure that everything ran right. And they did a really beautiful movie about the project and the relationship between the technicians, the American technicians and the Australians, and the teamwork and the telescope itself. And I'm telling you, it's there aren't too many movies out there about antennas, but this one's a good one, and I think any of our listeners, all of our listeners, would really appreciate that movie. So head on down to Blockbuster. Or let your fingers do the walk into Amazon.com. But this is definitely a must-see for radio amateurs. Five stars from M0HBR. KL7R, M0HBR.
A quick break there, Bill. I didn't get the name of the movie, over.
Oh, yeah. The Dish. That's it. And it's perfect. It's got an antenna title, too. The Dish. Go ahead.
I have never seen that, M0HBR, KL7R. I've never seen that. I've seen many movies that show Arecibo and showed the VLA, but I haven't, I never seen that. I didn't know anything about the Parkes radio telescope at all. I never heard of this. I've been to Chattanooga Radar outside of Fairbanks, and there's a NASA... NASA and European Space Agency tracking agency tracking station outside of Fairbanks, and I spent a night in there. A friend of mine, ham friend, worked out there, and I just said, I'd love to spend a night out there with you. He worked night shifts, so I went out there, and he put me to work. He was building this really oddball antenna, and he had me making this antenna. It was a capacitively coupled weird thing. It had something like 100 elements 10 feet long, and they had capacitors between the elements and all collinear and capacitively coupled. It was a weird thing. Anyway, I built it out there at NASA, and it was really cool to watch them track satellites and watch the Dish track and watch them collect the recordings, and it was good stuff. It could some guys have good jobs. In fact, I told you about the DC to DC converter I was playing with. Allowed you to take a 5-volt or 6-volt battery and turn it into 12 volts. And I was going to try to stick it in my KX1, my Elecraft KX1. I got that working. I got a Max 1771 chip from him, from Maxim IC, and replaced the one that burnt up, and replaced the switching FET that caught fire, and put in a new Mac 1771 DC to DC controller chip, and swapped out the burnt up FET for a 2N7000, and got it to put out 12 volts, but it didn't have enough current to drive the KX1 on transmit. So I swapped out the 2N7000 switching transistor for an IRF510 FET switching transistor, and the thing didn't even get warm, and put up 12 volts and worked great. So I went to Radio Shack and got and then I thought I could just hitch it up to the three battery, to half of the six batteries. There's a there's two 4.5 volt battery packages in the KX1 that are made from AA's, and I thought I could hitch up to just one of them for 4.5 volts and drive it up to 12, but it wouldn't work with enough current when the thing was transmitting. So I hitched it up by, I took all the batteries out of the KX1 and I put in a 4 AAA into the KX1, and then I put the DC to the DC converter, and so I had the DC converter, and it was driving the KX1 to 12 volts, and I was getting high power out of the KX1, and I was really happy. So I sent a note to the Elecraft mailing list, and one of the two owners of Elecraft came back. I forget his call sign right now. He's always pretty active on there, and he says, "Ah, great, excellent work, Mike." He says, "But since you were able to fit one of those 4 AAA battery packs in, why didn't you just use 2?" I completely missed the obvious. So after fuming a little bit for a day or so, I pulled out the DC to DC converter, and now my KX1 has two sets of 4 AAAs, and so I'm getting 12 volts the old-fashioned way, which is a lot more efficient there, Bill. M0HBR, KL7R.
KL7R, M0HBR, yeah, but the DC to DC converter was more of a technical challenge, so there you go. I played with one of those, with a DC to DC converter. I played with one time, and I didn't build it, but I have now two Doug DeMaw Barbados simple Superhet receivers. This was the first Superhet receiver that I ever built. I built one with just his standard VXO. Doug DeMaw really liked VXOs. And so my 20-meter Superhet uses a VXO, so the tuning range is limited to what you get from the crystal wiggle. But it was okay, and I used it quite a bit on 20. And then I got another one. A friend of mine on the internet, Dale, told me that he had built one using the Far Circuits PC board. But he had, good engineer that he is, he had done a lot of good mods on it. And one of the mods was to replace the VXO with a VFO driven or controlled rather by a varactor diode, and to increase the frequency range, he had used a DC to DC converter to boost the 12 volts, I think, up to something like 24 or 40 volts, so that you could get a wider frequency variation on the varactor. And so that was interesting. I played with that a while, but then I decided it was just not my kind of circuit, and went and took it out and went back to a VXO, and I've got that thing on 17 meters now, and I've got two crystals in there, and I could switch two frequency ranges on it, and I've got paired up with my homebrew 17 meter SSB transmitter using the crystal filter from a Swan 240, and built in a DX40 box. What a mess. Hey, but it's fun. Yeah. Well, you mentioned going out to the NASA facility. Yeah, I'd love to do that stuff. And one of the things that I want to see before we leave London is the big radio telescope up, the famous one up in Manchester, Jordell Bank. I think I'm pronouncing it right. I met one of the guys who works up there at an astronomy convention here a couple of weeks ago. And fortunately, I think my work requirements, my work responsibilities are going to take me up there. So we'll be visiting that spot. I always thought that would be a great job. You know, you say some guys have good jobs, and one of the great jobs I think that would be a wonderful job for a radio amateur is the job they call night assistant at a big astronomical telescope. And these big telescopes that they have up on tops of the mountains out in Hawaii and the Canary Islands and Palomar Mountain and all these places, you know, the scientists come out and do their research, but each one of these telescopes has a non-scientist kind of technician who's actually in charge of taking care of the telescope and preventing the scientists and their enthusiasm from damaging it. And the job title is night assistant. And the night assistant is responsible for opening up the dome and closing it when the humidity gets high, and protecting the mirror from rain or the misuse and abuse by the enthusiastic scientists who are out there for their observing sessions. And I always thought that would be a great job for a ham. You know, you go over on this big site, you're essentially dealing with this big, ultra high frequency parabolic dish, and you get to watch the scientists do their thing. Okay, time for another. Here we go. Cider Smoke book review. Great book called First Light. First Light by Richard Preston. It's about a bunch of scientists out there on I think it's Mount Wilson, if I recall right, using the big telescope and to study galaxies. And it's a great book for home brewers, because there's lots and lots of stuff in there about electronic home brewing, because the guys who were involved in this research project to scan the skies for galaxies that had not been discovered before had to build the electronics that they would connect to the telescope to allow them to basically do a visual scan and then come up with some detection software for the for discovering the galaxies. They were looking for quasars. And it goes into some detail about the electronic home brewing. There's some dumpster diving involved, lots and lots of use of surplus parts, and there's stories in there about their kind of, they call them the Palomar Mountain Gadgeteers. There's a job title for you. Gadgeteer at Palomar Mountain. There's a dream job for a radio amateur. And the leader of them is a really well-known astronomer named James Gunn. And they talk about him and his struggles and his mastery of the soldering iron. There's a guy who generates a lot of solder smoke to very good effect. So we've got a movie review and our first solder smoke book review. How about that, Mike? KL7R, M0HPR.
That's funny, Bill. And you're certainly animated about the book here, Bill. I read somewhere, I'm a programmer by profession, and a language is called Forth. One of the languages of which there are thousands is Forth, and it was generated by astronomers that needed to do microcode, basically, to control their satellite tracking, and so they said, well, here, I got a microcomputer, and I've got an assembler. Why don't I build a whole operating system in my spare time? And so they developed a Forth, early threaded language that people are still using. It's amazing. I've heard of that First Light. I've never read it. Yeah, I've heard of that. That's been recommended to me before. I might have to buy that thing up. So, Bill, I think it's probably time to wind down now. Something in your last transmission got me thinking about Bletchley Park and your Hi-Z headphones that you said may have actually been there. I think that's such a cool thing to think that maybe Turing himself might have had them things on his head is just is stunning to me. I think I'll let you go, Bill, with that M0HBR KL7R.
Yeah, I got to get up there to Bletchley Park. It's not far, and I understand they have some ham radio stuff up there too. So that's going to be one of the trips here from London. My kids are getting big enough, so we can more easily go to those kind of places. So maybe my son and I'll go up. Yeah. Who knows? Turing might have worn those headphones. Although I think he spent more time with the math than the headphones. Interesting guy. One last thing. Hey, listen, I wanted to mention this. I think it's a good way to wrap up a solder smoke that's been kind of astronomical. You know, they recently launched this probe out to Pluto, and it's going to take 9 years, I think, to get out to Pluto, where it will definitely be a QRP signal. But the thing I thought interesting was that they took some of the ashes from the cremation of the guy who discovered Pluto. I think his name is Clyde Tombaugh. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And they took a little bit of his ashes and they put the vial or the container inside the spacecraft. So it's on its way to Jupiter. So a bit of the discoverer is actually on his way out to Jupiter. I thought that was pretty cool. That's a fitting end for a guy who was into receiving signals, video signals from or visual signals from Pluto. And the other thing that was cool about this guy is there was the article that described this said that when Tombaugh was in his 90s, the Smithsonian approached him and asked him if they could have the telescope that he used to discover Pluto. And even though he was in his 90s, he sent back a very nice note saying, no, I'm sorry, you can't have the telescope because I'm still using it. Good one. All right, Mike, have a good night. It's time for me to get breakfast going here in London. The kids will be up in a little while. Have a good rest, and look forward to talking to you on the next edition of Solder Smoke. KL7R, near the Mendenhall Glacier, near Juneau, Alaska. This is M0HBR in central London. 7-3.